good horse, I called you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding.
You're listening to episode 541 of Unwelcome Guests, Out in Prison, Part 1. I'm Robin Upton. This week on the show, we're following up on Outing School, looking at the adult version, another institution which doesn't treat humans as fully autonomous beings with their own destinies, but which attempts to marshal them ostensibly for their own good and for the good of society. We're going to start with Sasha Abramski, author of American Furies, Crime, Punishment and Vengeance in the Age of Mass Imprisonment, which looks at the American prison system, and as far as he's concerned, the elephant in the room is the war on drugs. Now, I don't think he really gets to the heart of what prison is doing and why, but he certainly gives it an interesting set of perspectives to begin with, and then we're going to hear in our second hour from a couple of black American professors on what they consider to be the elephant in the room, the racial dimension of the prison system. Now here it's Sasha Abramski. Thanks to Ed Mays of Pirate TV Seattle for providing this recording from 2008.
The reason I focused for the last many years on the criminal justice system is because I like telling stories about the way our country functions. I like telling stories that can find a central lens and use that lens to focus on big societal and cultural and economic changes. And it seems to me that over the last 15, 20 years, increasingly the prisons, instead of being a marginal part of our society, instead of being a small self-contained system that we use as a policy of last resort when we can't think of a better way to deal with criminals, increasingly we've privileged the prison system and the broader criminal justice system. And what I mean by that is we've set in place a series of policies, and out of those policies we've created a series of institutions that mean that the criminal justice system is now central in any attempt to understand the American story in the 21st century. And I guess I'm going to do what I tell young writers not to do, and I'm going to take a chance here and hope I can get away with it. And I'll sort of basically open my presentation with a conclusion that through the war on drugs, through a series of public policy changes and public health changes around drugs, around mental illness, around how we deal with the homeless and our vagrant population and so on, through a series of policy changes cumulatively implemented over about 20, 25 years, we have redefined ourselves almost without realizing it as a prison nation. And when you think of America, you don't think of prisons. Generally, if you're not studying this obsessively, like I've unfortunately started doing, if you're not obsessive about prisons, you tend to think of the American dream. You tend to think of a land of optimism and opportunity, a very dynamic, flexible society, and so on. All of the great things that have created the American myth, and myths tend to sort of bleed into reality. So in creating the myth, they created, at least in part, a reality for much of our history. And increasingly, when you look at what's happening with the numbers of people going to prison, about 2.2 million people any given day at the moment are either in prison or jail. That means 1% of the adult population wakes up behind bars. About 5 million Americans are on parole and probation. Many millions more have been through the criminal justice mill in the recent past, but probably will go back into it at some point in the future. When you start looking at the numbers, when you realize that in many urban areas today, 1 in 4 young black men have current involvement with the criminal justice system. In much of the South, 1 in 4 young black men have been disenfranchised because of their involvement with the criminal justice system. They've lost the right to vote. When you look at all of this, it seems to me that in some very, very profound ways, we've lost that sense of optimism, that sense of social dynamism that's been so important to our history. And in the conclusion to the book, I have a section on the sort of emergence of a new Leviathan, the idea that increasingly, as the economic fabric of the country frays, as many of the social relationships that make up community fray, increasingly, the state acquires a more coercive role than it's had historically in America, a more coercive, controlling role in order to create and preserve order. And increasingly, the prison system is coming to serve that coercive role. It's coming to sort of be a pillar of a new Leviathan. One of the things that worries me about this is that societies are generally judged by what they become rather than what they were in their early formative stages. So we think of the Roman Empire, we think of empire, we think of the Caesars, we think of a very brilliant place in many ways, but also an extremely cruel place. When we think of the Soviet Union, very, very rarely do we think of the anti-war marches in St. Petersburg in 1916 and 17. We don't think of the anti-hunger marches. We don't think of any of the things that helped create the Soviet Union. We think, quite rightly, because it became dominant, of the Gulag. We think of a culture dominated by the mechanisms of imprisonment and punishment. And I worry that increasingly we're creating a very, very ugly historical legacy in America, that increasingly, as we overuse our criminal justice system, as we move into what might be called a hyper-incarceration era, where we're putting more of our population in prison than any other country on earth, increasingly, we're going to ultimately be seen to be a prison-dominated society, much the same way as the Soviet Union came to be. Now, without sort of being too grandiloquent about it, that seems to me a historical tragedy. There are so many wonderful things about the American experiment. There are so many idealistic things about the American experiment. If we ultimately degenerate, step by step, policy by policy, into being a prison-dominated society, we'll have lost something precious. And I think, more to the point, the world will have lost something precious. It will have lost, if we have any sort of moral credibility left at this point, I would argue that our prison system, in the long run, will shatter that moral credibility. And I think that's a very, very devastating historical development. So with that, I'm going to now let my book do most of my talking. I'm going to read you two passages from the introduction, which try and explain the nexus of public perception, economic interests, and political interests that have led to what I'm going to call a prison industrial complex, that have led to the emergence of an incarceration machine that has only very tangential relationship to the surrounding prevailing crime rates. And then after I read you those sections, I'm going to take you to a tiny town in West Texas called Pecos, and I'm going to read you a passage about how prisons increasingly in poor rural communities are being seen as a job creation program, and prisoners as a product that can prop up the local economy. So here's from the introduction. In ancient Greek mythology, the Erinyes, or Furies, rose periodically from out of the dark, cavernous underworld of Tartarus to avenge wrongs and to hound unpunished criminals, ironically nicknamed Eumenides, the well-wishers, by the populace. The Furies were usually portrayed as three wild-haired, robed female goddesses whose names in Greek meant unceasing, grudging, and avenging murder. So feared were these goddesses, these incarnations of humanity's elemental need for retribution, for the shedding of blood when wrongs have been done, that those pursued by the Furies were generally driven insane. When Orestes killed his mother, Clytemnestra, in revenge for her murder of Orestes' father, Agamemnon, Clytemnestra's soul conjured up the Furies to track her son down and persecute him. In Aeschylus's immortal theatrical trilogy dramatizing these events, the Oresteia, Orestes is chased around the Greek world until he is finally tried and then acquitted by the Council of Areopagus, the ancient Athenian judicial tribunal, fusing mythology and history. Aeschylus defines the struggle over this ruling and the Furies' eventual acceptance of it as the point in time when Greece was transformed from a land of blood feuds to one in which courts of law would prevail. This day a new order is born, says the leader of the Furies, and the goddesses, at least temporarily, fade away into the background. But goddesses as potent as the Erinyes never really die. At most, they go into hibernation, reawakening periodically to rise from the depths and wreak havoc. When Inquisition-era Europe whipped itself into a frenzy, believing that witches in league with the devil were conspiring to bring down the Christian order, tens of thousands of people were burned at the stake, hung, drowned, beheaded, crushed, and otherwise mutilated and killed. In some towns in Germany, hundreds of men, women, and children were publicly dispatched on specified execution days. The death cult lasted into the 17th century and beyond, famously infecting colonial America in the town of Salem, Massachusetts. When early Tudor England felt itself besieged by thieves, vagabonds, and otherwise idle poor, judges across the land responded by instigating an era of hanging that the Elizabethan chronicler John Stowe estimated a century later cost the lives of 70,000 people over four decades. An extraordinary number, considering that the country's entire population was barely in excess of 5 million at the time. Similar hysterias against putative threats to the existing social order appear with almost cyclical regularity across the continents and the millennia. And so it was that in the 1970s, the wild-haired ones began rubbing their eyes and stretching their arms, as once more they shook themselves out of their slumbers. By the 1980s, they were fully awake. They were no longer in the Mediterranean. Now they were hovering over the United States of America, a land becoming so consumed by its desire for revenge, its willingness to subjugate other social goals to this overriding end, that the politics and rhetoric around crime and punishment had assumed an almost mythic quality. Because sensibilities had changed since the witch trials and the wholesale shedding of blood was not acceptable in the ostensibly more civilized environs of late 20th century America, the Furies channeled their energies into a carefully constructed bureaucratic prison system. In 1980, the incarceration rate was just over 200 per 100,000, somewhat higher than it had been in 1970, still not too far off the historic norm. By 1990, however, it stood at 461 per 100,000. By 2000, it had risen to an astronomical 703 per 100,000. In the years since, it has gone up still further. By 2005, the Bureau of Justice Statistics was estimating that over 2.13 million people were living in the thousands of prisons and jails now dotting the country. In absolute numbers, the United States went from being a country that's incarcerated just under 475,000 people in 1980 to one with well over 2 million inmates. Nearly 5 million more were on either probation or parole. All told, by 2004, 7 million Americans were under the supervision of one or another criminal justice agency. Increases in incarceration that in the 70s and 80s could have been partially explained by concomitant rises in crime as an attempt to put a lid on escalating social chaos continued on into the 1990s and the 2000s, a period when crime rates were plummeting year in and year out. The Furies, once unleashed, were on a mission to sweep up the riffraff, to lock away the addicts and the bumbling, impoverished neighborhood nuisances, the mentally ill and the simply antisocial. By the turn of the 21st century, approximately 1 million Americans were in prison and jail after being convicted of non-violent crimes. It is hard to overstate the implications that this surging prison population has for American culture and politics, on local economies and on community structure. At any moment in time, more than 1 in 100 American adults are living behind bars, with the numbers even higher in the southern states. If the current trends continue, tens of millions of Americans will spend a significant portion of their adult life as prisoners. In some neighborhoods and in some racial and economic categories, more young men now go to prison than attend college. And in many states, since the mid-1990s, more tax dollars have been diverted into the criminal justice system than into public universities. In the post-World War II era, the GI Bill massively expanded access to higher education and fundamentally transformed the American economy and job market, creating the conditions for a dramatic increase in prosperity and access to middle-class lifestyles. More recent legislation, such as the 1986 Anti-Drug Abuse Act and the 1994 Omnibus Crime Bill, has had the reverse effect, ramping up popular involvement with the criminal justice system, paving the way for large-scale and overwhelmingly negative economic changes and cementing into place a growing American underclass. Told by a generation of politicians to be ever more afraid, encouraged by sensationalist media in an era of instant reporting to fear the chaos and the bloodlust lurking just beneath society's surface, Americans became progressively more hyped on prisons toward the end of the 20th century. Electorates obsessed with the next wave of drug addiction, the next random murder, the next gang-related atrocity, the next teenage psychopath, increasingly voted for politicians preaching a lock-em-up and throw-away-the-key approach to punishment, and correspondingly tolerated, even welcomed, an extraordinary diversion of public funds into criminal justice. Incarceration, along with the various feeder institutions that channel such a high percentage of Americans into jail and prison, is today a very big business. In 1982, the United States spent $19 billion on policing, $7.7 billion on the judicial system, and $9 billion on its prisons and jails. By 2001, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, it was spending $72 billion on policing, $37.5 billion on the judicial system, and close to $57 billion on the correctional system. While spending on the police had increased almost threefold, spending on incarceration had gone up more than fivefold. In the 5 years from 1990 to 1995 alone, more than 200 new prisons opened in the United States. And in the 2 decades from 1982 to 2001, the number of people working in the criminal justice system grew by nearly 1 million to over 2 million. Many people who in previous times might have sold patent medicine or marketed miracle cures for stress or developed gadgets to peel apples automatically now go into corrections. It's not that they know much about criminal justice or care deeply about penal philosophy. It's just that at the moment there's an awful lot of money floating around the world of incarceration. None of this ought to be surprising. Correctional professionals always stress that prisons are simply a mirror of the larger society. They are, says Jim Estelle, one-time director of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, a microcosm of the community. The United States today is a high-tech country with an extraordinary faith in techno-fix solutions. It's also a country that, alongside its democratic yearnings, has historically treated its poor and its lower classes in ways harsher than those of many other contemporary democracies. From the Reagan presidency onward, the United States' social policies increasingly mirrored that of Victorian England. While the overall society has gotten wealthier, the divides between haves and have-nots have multiplied. Access to welfare programs has been restricted, as has the food stamp program. State agencies that administer aid to the poor have come under increasing rhetorical attack from legislators, conservative cultural commentators, and radio shock jocks. Religious charities have become first providers to a homelessness crisis that local, state, and federal agencies have proven unable or unwilling to grapple with. The mentally ill, removed en masse from state mental hospitals during decades of deinstitutionalization, have been left without adequate community mental health facilities. Public schools have been underfunded, and the progressive tax base, upon which a vibrant public culture capable of tackling deep-rooted societal problems rests, has been denuded. Nationally, the real value of the minimum wage has declined by more than a third since its peak in 1968 at the height of President Lyndon B. Johnson's Great Society program. In 2005, the Forum on Child and Family Statistics reported that fully 18% of all children in the United States were living in poverty. The Victorians feared the nascent power of the great unwashed multitudes and built an entire prison philosophy around the notion of less eligibility. The idea that in a survival of the fittest society with already unpleasant ways of treating the free poor, prisons would have to create conditions manifestly worse than the worst of the free world to avoid being seen as desirable resting places for the destitute. It's no accident that the idea of make work, of prisoners running on a treadmill, not to produce anything but simply to keep them busy for hours at a time, was pioneered in the state-of-the-art prisons of mid-19th century England. In the United States today, the language might not be quite the same, but the underlying philosophy is, we need our prisons because our increasingly unequal society generates tremendous levels of addiction, mental illness, violence, and other social dysfunction. And we aren't willing to invest enough resources and social programs to tackle these problems and preserve societal order. At the same time, we don't want our prisons to be seen as a soft touch, as tax-supported rest stops or hostels for the poor, the hungry, or the unemployed. In a society with generous public assistance programs, the principle of less eligibility can still result in prisons with humane living conditions. In a society with corroded community welfare systems, the principle of less eligibility demands a race to the bottom within correctional settings. And it is this race that in recent times has largely determined the direction of criminal justice policy at the local, the state, and indeed the federal level. Electorates have demanded toughness, and politicians have thrived by out-toughing opponents with ever more punitive policy proposals. All right, so I hope that sort of sets the stage for some of the politics and some of the economics around incarceration. Now, one of the things I've found most surreal in this research is that when you go to poor rural communities, oftentimes people are begging to have prisons, especially the local political leadership, which sees it as a job creation tool. And it's extraordinary to me that something like a prison, which 25 years ago no community wanted, today is mega business. Sometimes it's mega business with private companies providing the impetus. And sometimes it's the local county itself that builds a prison, hoping it can lure in prisoners and get paid a per diem rate to house them. And I'm going to read you a passage which sort of brings in all of the above. It's a combination of very greedy local commissioners and the private prison system coming together in this tiny town in Texas. And before I talk about Pecos, I had earlier talked about this prison town in Arizona, a place called Florence, Arizona, which has 3,000 people who are free and 17,000 people who are prisoners. It's the largest prison town in the country. Anyway, here's Texas. Close to 600 miles southeast of Florence, Arizona, the dying oil town of Pecos in the remote West Texas county of Reeves was praying that GEO Group could bring to town 800 state prisoners from Arizona, and fast. Pecos, bona fide cowboy territory, home of the world's first rodeo in 1883, boomed in the 1950s as farmers' pockets flush with cotton dollars. It declined somewhat in the 1960s, and in the 70s it boomed again, floating on the West Texas oil rush. In the 1980s, when the local oil industry bottomed out, the city once more lost its bearings. Its population of 13,000 started dwindling, then collapsing towards its present level of 9,000. Young people started leaving. Cinder block and wood houses were left to decay, and the dry, dusty desert began to reclaim the abandoned lots. Ugly and aimless, Pecos began casting around for a third boom. With prisons, Reeves County officials thought that they had found the answer. In the late 1980s, the county issued revenue bonds to build a 1,000-bed prison, which it then leased out to the Federal Bureau of Prisons. In the mid-90s, a newly elected judge, Jimmy Galindo, and the four county commissioners arranged for another bond issue to construct a second 1,000-bed prison. Again, the Fed stepped in with a nice contract, lured by the low per diem rates charged by Reeves County. Outside the prison system, however, things were going from bad to worse. A decade-long drought crippled local farming. A local frozen food company closed down, taking more than 500 jobs with it. And a salt mine shut, taking 800 more jobs. Prisons, as well as the ubiquitous edge-of-town Walmart, were, it seemed, the only source of income. Against this backdrop, Galindo and the commissioners got greedy, as in several other impoverished, politically disempowered Texas counties in recent years. In Reeves County, the political leadership adopted a prison-building scheme that in practice, if not in theory, put the county at huge financial risk, enriched a few contractors and prison companies, and left a wealth of bad feeling and mistrust in their wake, with no indication that the Bureau of Prisons was interested in a third Pecos facility. Galindo and the commissioners authorized the issuance of bonds for yet another addition to the prison. Taking the total value of the bonds issued for prisons since the late 1980s to $90 million, a vast sum in a county with an annual budget of only $5 million. Costing tens of millions and built entirely on spec, the prison, a prefab shard on a windswept desert plateau, opened for business in the fall of 2003. Judge Galindo really thought he could make Pecos the prison capital of the United States, declared County Treasurer Linda Clark, who vehemently opposed building the third prison. Not because she didn't like the idea of making money off of prisoners, but because she thought it was an unsound business proposition. There was, as Clark had feared, only one problem with Galindo's plan. The federal government had decided it didn't want to send any more prisoners down to Pecos. Some disgruntled officials believed this might have been because so many locals were failing the background check for employment at the existing two facilities due to criminal convictions in their own past. With no prisoners and no incoming money, Reeves County found itself having to service a bond debt that came close to $500,000 per month. The alternative was to let the debt go unserviced and forfeit both ownership of the prison and the county's ability to issue bonds in the future. What little money the county had been making on its contracts with the Bureau of Prisons for the first two facilities now went back into servicing a debt for the empty third prison. Galindo abruptly left his office in the county courthouse and set up shop in a small building within the sprawling prison complex a mile southwest of town. There, carefully guarding the paperwork relating to the deal from the prying eyes of his county treasurer and auditor, he began, according to other county officials, desperately wooing the private prison sector, hoping it would come in and bail out the county. At the end of 2003, GEO Group did agree to step in and take over the three facilities on a 10-year contract and to use its out-of-state contacts to bring in prisoners to fill the empty, dollar-eating third site. Since the prison was already built and the county had to service the debt, it was essentially a risk-free proposition for the corporation. Moreover, according to County Auditor Lynn Owens, as soon as the total prison population for the three facilities rose above 2,200, GEO's monthly fee for the county would rise from $62,500 to $330,000, whether that population was 2,201 or 3,000. Since the two existing prisons already had a combined population of more than 2,000, since the county still had to pay the guards' salaries, prisoners' medical expenses, programming costs, food expenses, and utilities, Owens believed that this contract negotiated by Galindo was something of a sweetheart deal for the private company. So why pay GEO that much money? We spent almost a year now trying to attract inmates to the detention center, Owens explained resignedly. We haven't attracted them. Through GEO's expertise, they can generate us inmates. Using that expertise, GEO immediately began wooing Arizona, a state that imported thousands of prisoners from Alaska and Hawaii to do time in its private facilities, while in a weird manifestation of the logic of the global marketplace, simultaneously exporting its own state prisoners to private sites in Texas and Oklahoma. For Alaska and Hawaii, it was cheaper to send their inmates to private prisons in Arizona rather than building their own new prisons. Meanwhile, Arizona, which had an abundance of prisons, found it could get a better per diem rate to house excess prisoners in private prisons in Texas counties than in its own facilities. We're going to have to pay all the bills, complained Clark bitterly. The county is responsible for everything. Except that GEO is going to manage the facilities. It's a sweet deal. They manage the prison, and they try to get us on our feet, get us some inmates in here. Hopefully we'll sign a contract with Arizona. They're the only ones who will send us any inmates. Three of the four Reeves County commissioners didn't return phone calls asking for comment on the GEO deal when I visited Pecos in the spring of 2004. The fourth, Felipe Arredondo, arranged to meet me at the courthouse at 8 o'clock one morning. He showed up in theatrical style, wearing knockoff Ray-Ban sunglasses, a 10-gallon hat, a baseball jacket, khakis and cowboy boots. But he stayed only long enough to say that the other commissioners and the judge had forbade him to talk. And then he dashed out to his green pickup truck, which he had with a further flair for the dramatic, left running outside. Galindo himself ignored repeated phone messages and visits to his courthouse office. I finally managed to corner him in his prison office early one morning. The judge was a large man with salt and pepper hair and an ingratiating smile that rapidly turned sour when asked questions about the prisoners. He stated that he wanted to provide information, but he was legally prevented from doing so by a clause in the contract with the Federal Bureau of Prisons. When I pointed out that there was no contract, Galindo insisted that there soon would be. Would he show me that contract and that provision? Sure, he answered, all smiles, but only if I hired a lawyer and filed a formal public information request. The important thing for me to understand, the judge insisted, was that he was only interested in providing jobs to his constituents. It's unfortunate that so many people are incarcerated, he said, a slight frown of empathy on his face. But given the laws with regards to drug trafficking and other illegal activities, that trend more than likely is not going to slow down. I believe we provide a vital service to our customers. We live in a part of the country where it's very difficult to create and sustain jobs. Prisons become a very clean industry for us to provide employment to citizens. I look at it as a community development project. When I came in, it was a $6 million operation. As we speak, it's a $36 million operation. I hope you look at it from our perspective, as a community development project. And that's where I'm going to end the reading. I think that sort of sums up very nicely what's happening here and why we're building so many prisons. I'll take whatever questions you have.
You're certainly right. There are some states that are experimenting with what's called restorative justice. And it's this idea, and it's actually a very sensible idea, that if you can bring a victim and a criminal together, and if you can show the criminal the damage that their actions have caused, it's actually a very powerful rehabilitative tool. And there's a lot of research on this, that this is actually one of the effective ways of breaking the criminal cycle. And one of the things that happens is a lot of states will use the restorative justice model, at least in part, as an alternative to imprisoning people. They might lower the prison sentence if the criminal goes through a rehabilitation or restorative justice process. or they might have community service in lieu of a sentence. And you might, in some states, for example, one of the things that will happen is a relatively low-end criminal will have to do community service that might directly benefit the victim. I'm not sure if the trade-off for that is that there are empty prison beds and therefore those states are able to rent out prison beds to other states. I haven't read that, and I would actually doubt it, because even in the states with restorative justice, prison population is going up. I think one of the only states in the country with a declining prisoner population is New York. And New York has had these, you know, startling reductions in crime, and it actually has fed back in the prison system. It's still way higher than it was at the beginning of the prison boom, but it's lower than it was 5-10 years ago. But other than New York, almost every state in the country still has a growing prison population. So I would very much doubt that that's why they're renting out prison beds, but I might be wrong on that. I think what's happened is we've created a rhetoric in which we've allowed a very, very conservative approach to punishment to come to be defined as tough on crime. We've ceded the language in the same way as in the 80s and 90s, liberals somehow ceded the language of morals and values to Christian conservatives. And I've never understood that, you know, this idea that only the Christian coalition has a right to talk about morals and values. But we ceded that language for a while. And we did the same thing with crime. A lot of research said the best kind of anti-crime strategy was very labor-intensive, rehabilitation-intensive. You had to put the people in there who could provide drug counseling, education, treatment, mental health counseling, whatever it might be. And if you can do that, and if you can then divert a significant number so they don't go to prison in the first place, if you can bulk up community mental health programs, let's say, that's a really good way to reduce crime. But that wasn't what was defined as tough on crime. What was defined as tough on crime was harsher and harsher and harsher conditions, longer and longer sentences for low-end inmates, putting juveniles into adult prisons, putting low-end drug users into prisons, talking about taking out the perks from prisons and making prisoners know they're in prison instead of a Holiday Inn. All that sort of cheap rhetoric and soundbite politics came to be defined as tough on crime. And in that scenario, it's going to take a very, very brave politician to go against the currents and say, well, actually, let's step back, let's look at this, let's work out whether programming works. Very few politicians were willing to do that. And so you saw this sort of legislative rollback. Correctional experts hated it. Correctional professionals on the whole, long-term correctional professionals who'd made a career working inside prisons, generally hated these changes, and I talked with a lot of them in my book. It was politics-driven, not policy-driven, but soundbite politics-driven. And the second thing that happened is, as the laws got tougher, as we started putting in prison people who in the past we never would have put in prison, and not just putting them in for a year or two, but handing out decades-long sentences, the size of the population spiraled. It went up 500% in a 25-year period. Now, we're a wealthy nation. You know, we have a lot of money at our disposal. But even the wealthiest nation on earth doesn't have the resources to do intensive rehabilitation-based programming for 2.2 million people. It would bankrupt the country. It would bankrupt every state and every locality, even if they could find enough people willing to work in prison settings. And that's a whole other issue. There just aren't that many people trained, four-year college-educated people who want to work in prisons. It's not a very pleasant environment to work in. So I'm arguing, and I try and develop this in my book, the larger a country makes its prison system, the more it's going to have to rely on a warehousing model to incarcerate those people. The scale of the system becomes the problem. And even if the individual guards aren't intentionally violent and sadistic, and most guards aren't, some are, but most aren't, even if they're not intentionally sadistic, they're operating in an increasingly toxic environment. And that means that the default increasingly in a prison setting becomes violence. It becomes an absolute power-based hierarchy with fear as the sort of glue. And in that setting, rehabilitation is doomed. So I think unless we can work out a public policy response that lowers the numbers that we're sending into prison, we're never going to be able to recreate a strong rehabilitation structure nationwide. We've created a series of, you can call it prison industrial complex if you like, a series of political and economic interests that really have a powerful stake in maintaining a large and growing prison system, regardless of the prevailing crime rates. In creating that, we've made it harder and harder to successfully argue against it. We've created a sort of series of feedback loops that make it harder and harder to channel people away from prison. and harder to channel the resources into rehabilitation. And if you like, you can sort of consider it the Walmart model of incarceration. We do it on a huge scale, and we do it cheaply, as opposed to doing it on a smaller scale, but having a higher quality of service. So it's the sort of, this is a sort of very crude analogy, but it's the boutique model versus the Walmart model. And we've chosen the Walmart model. And even if states, the privatization issue is something of a red herring when you're talking about why the system is so large, because only 6% of prisoners are in private prisons. But for the last 20 years, every correctional agency in the country has had the threat of privatization hanging over them. So even if it doesn't materialize, politicians periodically say, well, unless you do it cheaper, we're going to privatize, and you're going to lose your bureaucratic turf. And so there's a tremendous incentive if you're in charge of a state correctional system and you want to protect your turf. There's a tremendous incentive to go the Walmart route, because the more often you can do it cheaply, the more you can protect your turf. To sort of put it in the basest economic terms, what kind of bang for the buck do you get? We're now spending $100 billion a year. I mentioned $57 billion. That was about 4 years ago. We're now spending about $100 billion a year running the world's biggest prison system. Now, the question is, every year, we're putting another 50 to 60,000 people into that system. And the question is, at the margins, for every person we now incarcerate extra, how much are we reducing the crime rate by? And it's a tiny, tiny number at this time. So the sort of better analysis is, if we took a significant amount, let's say we only incarcerated 1 million people instead of 2 million. That would still leave all the violent offenders in prison, but we said for non-violent offenders, especially drug addicts, there's probably a better way to deal with them than incarceration. And we release several tens of billions of dollars and we invest it in drug education programs, we invest it in after-school programs for kids, we invest it in a really good community mental health structure. Then the question is, could we get a bigger bang for our buck? And most of the research says yes. RAND Corporation has analyzed the numbers on drug addiction in particular. And RAND Corporation found you get about a 3 times better return on drug treatment than on incarceration. A conservative criminologist called Al Bloomstein had a Carnegie Mellon. And I like quoting conservatives because, they're much, much harder to just dismiss as being sort of on the loony fringe. Al Bloomstein crunched the numbers, and he's an expert on this, and he crunched the numbers, and he said you can attribute at most 25% of the drop-off in crime in the 90s to higher incarceration rates. So, the crime rate fell by about 50% in the 1990s. What he's saying is maybe 12% of the total fall-off in crime, the 12% reduction, maybe that was due to rising incarceration, which means we incarcerated 1 million more people in the 1990s for drop-off in crime of 12%. So, it seems to me the question isn't whether or not it reduces crime, but what we can do better and cheaper. In my book, I don't minimize the seriousness of a lot of crimes and the damage that those crimes do. But one of the things I thought I would do in my book was do a little research. How did our grandparents' generation choose to deal with the worst offenders of the mid-20th century, the Nuremberg war criminals, the Nazi war criminals tried in Nuremberg after World War II. And a number of death sentences were handed out and carried out. And then for the people who weren't executed, the rest were given prison sentences. And the majority of Nazis tried at Nuremberg were not executed. Rudolf Hess and a couple others, I believe, were given life sentences after World War II. Most of the other Nuremberg defendants were given a maximum of 20 years. Albert Speer, and this is the example I use in the book, Albert Speer, who was Hitler's confidant, Hitler's right-hand man, was given a 20-year sentence and by the mid-1960s was free. And so I thought, this is interesting. These are the worst criminals in international history, basically, certainly in the recent past. And our grandparents' generation gave them 20 years in prison. Today there are 200,000 Americans serving a longer sentence than that. And some of them, like yourself, you said manslaughter. So, some of the 200,000 have been convicted because there is blood involved. A significant number are drug offenders. I interviewed people serving life sentences in Louisiana for heroin dealing in the 1970s. Street dealing. I'm not talking about kingpins, but street dealing. I interviewed middle-aged men in Alabama serving life under habitual offender laws for marijuana. I've interviewed shoplifters in California serving life under 3 strikes. It seems to me that there's a moral disequilibrium there, that we're now giving out routinely longer sentences than we gave to top Nazi war criminals. And that, you know, that's another sort of recalibration of who we are as a society, I think. We're underinvesting in a whole array of public services, schools just being one part of the larger picture. We're underinvesting in those public services, and we're underinvesting in the people who use those public services until they get involved in the criminal justice system. And at that point, we release a bunch of money. And the best way to sort of explore that, I don't actually think it's with schools. It's with what's called million-dollar blocks in New York and a couple other cities. And million-dollar blocks are blocks that researchers have studied in poor neighborhoods, high-density poor neighborhoods, where the state is now spending $1 million a year incarcerating residents from one city block. And there's a number of these streets in New York and Washington, D.C., a bunch of other places, where the state is now spending $1 million a year on incarceration of residents. And if you think, what would you, you know, if the state released those kind, that kind of money earlier in the process, put in place extra money for jobs in poor neighborhoods, extra money for schools in poor neighborhoods, after-school programs and so on. Unless you're an absolute pessimist about the human condition, you've got to believe that's going to have an impact on how people behave and what they do to get money. So I would say the underinvestment in public services as a whole creates a momentum towards incarceration. I would say another fascinating example of what the convergence, if you like, between prisons and schools. Increasingly in poor neighborhoods, to go to school, you have to go through metal detectors, you have to be strip searched in some cases by guards. Bob Herbert wrote about this in the New York Times last week. Guards in some poor neighborhoods in New York are now strip searching kids going into school and patting them down. And you think, you know, that's a real tragedy. The school is supposed to be a time when you actually learn things and you actually have sort of some sense of opening about your ability to interact with the world. And in poor neighborhoods today, increasingly schools look like prisons. And, you know, that's really weird, that we're raising a generation of kids who expect to be going through metal detectors and being searched just to go to class in the morning. Now, I don't have any easy answers to that, because I know there's violence in many schools, and I know that there are weapons in many schools. But I do think it says something about what kind of a society we're becoming, that sort of thing is thought to be needed and is accepted.
Can you talk a little bit about the class war aspect of it?
Yeah, I'll tell you how I'm going to answer that. And, you know, if you'd asked me this 15 years ago when I was in college, I would have given you a sort of table-thumping class war analysis. I don't think I'm going to do that here. I don't think that there is a conscious attempt to do something which is literally a class war. What I do think there is a series of policies being put in place, economic policies, social policies, and so on, which have the effect of concentrating wealth at the top and have the effect of denying opportunity at the bottom. It might have the same impact as a class war. I just don't think our society is functioning in a specifically class war framework. I think we're doing it almost by accident. Or rather, let me rephrase that. I think there are certain people at the top of the society who are crafting a political and an economic agenda that they know full well will concentrate opportunity and income at the top. I think the people who are voting for that aren't voting, they're not thinking about class war when they're voting. And this to me is absolutely fascinating, that when you know, a law like three strikes and you're out in California passes by popular vote, overwhelming majority supports it in 1993-94. And it's portrayed as being law that's going to get the repeat violent predators, murderers, rapists, and so on, off the streets forever. And there are very few people who are going to mount an effective political campaign against that. Someone's committed murder three times, yeah, lock them up and throw away the key. But that's not who gets sent to prison for three strikes. The people who get sent to prison for three strikes tend to be the chronic low-end offenders, people who commit a lot of crimes, but they're not necessarily serious crimes, each and every one. And most of them are drug-related. So in one of my earlier books, I write about a guy called Billy Ochoa. He gets 326 years on 13 counts of welfare fraud, and he dies in prison. He's a heroin addict, been a heroin addict his whole adult life, and he's got a ton of crimes, but most of them are low-end. And he strikes out on $2,000 of welfare fraud divided into 13 separate cases, $50 here, $75 there, and so on. He goes to prison for the rest of his life. Price tag to the California taxpayer has got to be about $1 million. Doesn't serve anyone's interest. This guy could far better either be put into a treatment model in the community, made to do community service, whatever it might be. It doesn't really serve anyone's interest to have him locked up for life. But three strikes and you're out is such a potent soundbite policy that it's almost impossible to argue against rationally. And I think this has happened across the board, whether we're talking about three strikes and you're out, whether we're talking about mandatory minimums for drug sentences, whether we're talking about channeling more and more money into building supermax prisons. The effect is a more unequal, unfair society. The effect is to lock into place an underclass, which isn't just one generation, but is multi-generational, because if you take away someone's ability to earn money and so on, you're affecting their kids too. You're making it more likely that they'll also fail in the society and end up in prison. I think the effect clearly has an economic ramification, but I'm going to steer away from calling it class war because I don't think that that's how our society generally divides up its politics at this moment, consciously. California has the worst recidivism rates in the country. About 65% of its parolees bounce back into prison within 3 years. One of the reasons California has 175,000 inmates, which is a spectacularly large number, one of the reasons is the majority of its prisoners are parole violators. They haven't committed new crimes. They're violating technical terms of parole. So it's clearly an important part of the equation, getting in place programs either inside prison, the kind you mentioned, or on the outside through a better functioning parole system, better reentry programs and so on. Getting in place programs that are going to help reintegrate people when they come out of prison into the community, provide job opportunities, provide housing. I've done a lot of work with a group called the Fortune Society in New York that provides housing to recently released drug addicted ex-offenders. And it works with them and works with them and works with them. If they have a dirty urine, they don't get bounced straight back into the prison system. It keeps working with them and it has very, very good data. They actually reduce the return to prison rate. So definitely that's one part of the equation. Your first question, who's going to prison? The elephant in the room is drugs, and it's always going to be drugs in this conversation. In 1973, we declared war on drugs. That was Nixon's phrase, the war on drugs. And for 35 years, we have fought essentially a military campaign against a public health problem. That's what drug addiction is, how most countries deal with it. Most countries deal with drug kingpins as criminals, and they deal with drug users and street dealers as people with a sickness. That's how Canada generally deals with it, how England deals with it. Most countries that we consider, you know, fairly similar to us culturally, politically, economically, have a much greater emphasis on public health. And for 35 years, we've downplayed public health and we've overemphasized interdiction and arrest and incarceration of low-end offenders. And it's a useless strategy. I don't care whether you're for, I don't care what your position is on drug usage. I don't care whether you think that all drugs should be illegal or all drugs legal. Whatever you think on drugs, simply locking people up doesn't work. But 32% of all cases that go through state courts now are just about drugs. Not drugs plus something else, but 32% are just drugs. And the effect is, in the late 70s, Federal Bureau of Prisons had 20-something thousand inmates. Today it has nearly 200,000, almost all to do with drugs. California, 21,000 inmates in 1978, 175,000 today. Texas, 20-something thousand inmates in the 1970s, 165,000 today. And the bulk of that change is because we've changed the way we've dealt with drugs and we've over-incarcerated low-end drug users. It doesn't stop drug addiction. If it did, we'd walk down the streets and never see drug usage, never see drug dealing. Fact is, you can go any city, any hamlet at this point in the countryside, you're going to find drugs if you want drugs. One of the paradoxes here is that this change in how we deal with a host of issues has essentially been a democratic change. It might be that there's been a manipulation of the political process. There has been. But it has occurred with popular consent. This isn't a hidden issue that's occurred in a dictatorship in which most people don't know anything about. Three strikes and you're out was voted in. The politicians who supported mandatory minimums got popular support. The sheriffs that I write about, people like Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Arizona, who proposed these, you know, absurdly punitive responses to criminals, they win re-election. This is a problem of perception, and as long as the public is going to lend its support to soundbite politics, the prison system is going to continue to grow. Not because people think that they're incarcerating low-end drug offenders. They don't. People think they're incarcerating violent, predatory offenders. And as long as there's that disjunct between the myth and the reality, as long as people still think the reason we have 2.2 million prisoners is because we have 2.2 million murderers and rapists, which we don't have, then the prison populations continue to build. And what you said about non-violent prisoners being brutalized or made mentally ill by the prison, that's an enormous problem. And, you know, all over the country, you can go into prisons and see that in action. The people who went in with some problems come out with even bigger problems. And people who went in may be non-violent, but drug addicted, oftentimes come out violent. And that's a huge problem because it's going to lead to a sort of multi-decades long cycling in and out of the criminal justice system. I mean, your discussion of a 16-year-old going to prison for 40 years, I don't think there's a single person alive who would like to be judged by the actions that they carried out when they were teenagers. Now, obviously, some actions are more destructive and more long-lasting in their effects than others. But I know I'm not the same person I was when I was 16. I can't imagine anyone in this room is the same person they were when they were 16. And the idea that you can keep an adult in prison for the rest of their life for a crime they committed when they were a teenager, unless you're talking about a serious sociopathic serial killer, and there are some, but unless you're talking about a sociopath, then I think it's extremely hard morally to justify lifelong incarceration for what someone did as a teenager. The baseline is corrections systems are trying to do things in bigger quantity and in cheaper quantity, in cheaper per person quantity. The complicating factor is the supermax prison system, which is one of the fastest growing parts of the prison system, and it's extraordinarily expensive to run. Now, it still has a Walmart approach to rehabilitation. It doesn't provide any. It has this sort of bargain basement attitude to rehabilitation. But in terms of manning a supermax, first of all, it costs about $250 million to build a supermax, but to staff it is fiendishly expensive because of what you said. There's a very high ratio. It's not five guards per prisoner, but it is a very high ratio of staff to prisoners. And the prisoners are kept in isolation units. Whenever they're let out of their cell, which is very, very rarely, there have to be two guards escorting them to any place. And it costs a fortune. That comes under a category that I call incarceration hedonism. And what I mean by that is, if it feels good, we'll do it regardless of the cost. And one of the things that's happened is we've increasingly decided as a society that it feels good to create really, really, really bad conditions for the people we're told are the worst of the worst. So we have now the most secure prisons in the world, bar none, for our top-end offenders. And there's certainly room to argue that there are some criminals and some individuals who are so dangerous that they need to be held in a Pelican Bay-like condition. There are people, I've met people like that, who are really, really scary and really, really violent, and if you let them in a social setting, they're going to hurt somebody. And they need something like Pelican Bay. But the majority of people who end up in these high-end prisons, and this is being found in court case after court case around the country, majority of the ones who end up inside the supermax prisons are either people who are creating trouble in the broader prison system. They're not necessarily dangerous, but they're agitators. And they get shipped off into these high-end prisons as a way of sort of silencing them. Or they're severely mentally ill. And they don't obey prison rules. They hurt themselves. They disobey orders. They throw food. They do nasty stuff with bodily fluids, all kinds of just horrendous stuff. And they don't obey the rules because they're sick. But they're dealt with as a disciplinary problem. And they're given a disciplinary ticket, and they go before a disciplinary board, and they're shipped off to an isolation unit. And then they further go crazy, basically. I mean, that's sort of simplifying it. But it's a very good mechanism to drive already edgy people over the edge. But increasingly, that's what we're doing. So, you know, I mean, Pelican Bay definitely complicates the Walmart model. I can't think of a sort of commercial analogy to it, but it's basically we're putting a ton of money at the high-end prisons, but we're still not rehabilitating people. So it's like the worst of all worlds, in a sense. In all fairness, there's still a lot of court cases going through the system, and a lot of times judges actually intervene, and they say, you know, you can't deny medical services, you can't put the mentally ill in isolation. It's actually fairly common for the courts to intervene. There are independent ombudsmen in some states. The media in many states serves as a fairly semi-efficient watchdog. It depends on the state. California has basically barred the media from its prisons. It's haphazard. And oftentimes what happens is a problem will be identified, but the courts will be extremely reluctant to take action. They'll give the correctional system leeway or discretion. And there's a whole bunch of court cases where precedent's been set saying, you know, the default assumption is unless you can prove intentional harm, intentional neglect, that's a pretty high threshold. Unless you can prove intentional harm, the courts are going to step back. And, you know, to my mind, that's a big structural problem, that there just isn't an effective oversight body at a national level. All pendulums swing. And this pendulum is just like any other. It will swing at some point. always has in American history. You get reaction, progress on the criminal justice system. For 200 years that's been the case. We've had a long swing in one direction. Might keep swinging for a while longer, but at some point it will change. Might not change in exactly the way I'd like it. Might not lead to a lowering of the prison population in the way I'd like it. But the status quo will shift in some states and some policies. I think that's probably a given. The other question, what would happen if we decriminalized drugs, is a good question. Certainly there's a good public health argument that can be made for at least selective decriminalization of at least some drugs. Maybe that's not an argument that we'd like to agree with, but there's at least room there to have that debate. It's a serious issue, and there are serious people on both sides of the issue. There are certainly arguments against legalization, but there are many public health experts who say it's actually the policy that would reduce the harm the most. Governor of New Mexico a few years ago, a very conservative man called Gary Johnson, became the first governor in America to urge drug decriminalization because he said the war on drugs was unwinnable, and he wanted more money spent on public health instead of law enforcement. Obviously, it didn't go anywhere in New Mexico, but it, you know, at least opens up the argument that it's a legitimate issue to talk about. What would happen if drugs were decriminalized? You're right, the drug gangs and cartels that in some cases control national economies and governments in some instances would be in real trouble. In the same way as when prohibition was ended and alcohol was re-legalized, the mob was in trouble. It had to look for other ways to earn money because suddenly you could go to the corner and buy a beer. You didn't have to rely on the speakeasies that were controlled by Al Capone and his crowd. And I think, you know, there's definitely something there that if we didn't have such an emphasis on the drug war, and if we dealt with this in more of a public health way and less of a law enforcement and military way, there's an argument to be made that a lot of very powerful players in a lot of countries would be very uncomfortable.
That seems to be a well-made parallel between prison and drug dealing. Seems to be pretty much the same people in charge of both, with the same amount of concern for human welfare, i.e. none at all. Prison seems to be a fairly logical outgrowth of school, and both of them manifest the same thought of separation, the same idea of domination and control. This is one that will be all too familiar to many of the US citizens of color. That was not a dimension that he brought out as a white middle-class person, perhaps not something that had crossed his path. Now we're going to correct that with Assistant Professor Vivian Salihana speaking on black history and its close links to the incarceration industry.
I always say that if I talk about prisons, it's impossible not to talk about white supremacy, because white supremacy created the criminal justice system that we have today. And I also want to clarify that when I talk about criminal justice, that I am talking about a criminal type of justice system. So it's not necessarily justice, it's just criminal justice. Does that make sense? So always keep that in mind, because we're taught through the language and institutions to criminalize each other or communities. And I think that on many levels, the titles that they give their own institutions are very telling. So it's the criminal justice system. And at the root of this criminal justice system is this concept of segregation, which we often associate with the Jim Crow laws and apartheid, and we know that that's sort of the height and most visible forms of white supremacy. At the root of the concept of criminal justice is the idea that segregation is necessary and natural, and also the idea that segregation provides safety, when really segregation is something that breaks and ruptures and murders. And so also to keep that in mind, that this concept of criminal justice is based on segregation. And I also, what I want to do for this presentation is talk about where this concept of segregation came from, and I want to do it from a historical perspective, because I think as somebody who studies prisons and does work inside prisons, sometimes you get wrapped up in the immediate institution of imprisonment, and then you lose sight of the larger picture. So for the past year, I've been trying to figure out this larger picture. And having gone to school for criminology and criminal justice and sitting through some of the most fascist university classrooms you can sit through and receiving a PhD in fear, which is a PhD in criminal justice, I at some point had to step back, which is why I started doing research with music and looking at lyrics that trace the cross-Atlantic slave route, so lyrics from Nigeria, the Caribbean, and the United States, and looking at what people in the lyrics are saying about justice and white supremacy.